panel consists of me, Wade Birdwell. The justice to my left is Mike Wallach. The justice to my right is Dana Womack. And we will be hearing this case. So if the clerk will call the case, please.
The court will now call Lance Howerton versus American Precision Ammunition et al. May it please the court, Mr. Stephen Hillinger will argue for appellant, and Mr. Luke DeSero will argue for appellee.
We'll hear from the appellant at this point in time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. This is a case involving a motion to dismiss that was filed pursuant to Section 101.106F of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and actually really presents only one issue for determination, and that is the issue of whether the claims at which the motion was directed could be considered to have been brought under the Tort Claims Act for the purposes of Section 101.106. And not only does it just present that one issue, it's an issue that the Texas Supreme Court has already decided relatively definitively.
Counsel, has the court actually dealt with the interaction between 101.106F, or E for that matter, and 101.0215B?
I don't know.
I have not found any case other than a federal case that deals with both of those and then just ignores the issue that's presented to us. It finds that, I forget the name of it, Garcia, I think, Galvez versus City of Katy.
Yes, Your Honor.
In 2019, where the court finds that there is a proprietary argument made by the plaintiff and therefore allows her to go forward with her cause of action, but then turns around and dismisses the individual employees under 101.106F, but does so because the plaintiff didn't actually address that, pretty much just kind of conceded the point, and then there was no discussion of the interaction between those two. But that's the only case that I have actually found where the two are together and arguably addressed. And they come to the conclusion, I think, that, you know, I'm trying to figure out who it might support under the circumstances. But the bottom line is, and here's my question. Since 101.106F is a part of Chapter 101, and 101.0215B categorically states that Chapter 101, which would include 101.106F, does not apply to proprietary conduct by a municipality, are you not getting the cart before the horse under the circumstances, and you're asking us to apply Chapter 101 when they've demonstrated that it doesn't because it's a proprietary function issue?
Yes, Your Honor. And I understand, an appellant understands the facial appeal of the argument that's being made by the appellees. But I think to answer your question, it has been addressed by the Texas Supreme Court, and I want to talk about that. Now, whether 101.0215B has specifically been addressed, I don't know of a case that specifically addresses that. But I also, in answer to your question, will refer you to a couple of Supreme Court cases that talk about intentional tort claims, which also, like proprietary function claims, the Texas Tort Claims Act specifically says this chapter does not apply.
Right, 057 to claims for intentional tort says it doesn't apply.
Nonetheless, the Texas Supreme Court on at least two occasions has said claims for intentional torts, to which a 101.106F defense is raised, are claims that could have been brought under the Tort Claims Act. It has found that. And it's because the analysis that's supposed to occur at the 101.106F stage, and this is discussed in Franca versus Velasquez and the Fink case and some others that are cited in our brief, the only thing the court is supposed to do at the 101.106F motion stage to determine if a claim could have been brought under this chapter is two issues. One, does the claim sound in tort? Two, is there an independent statute other than the Tort Claims Act that specifically authorizes that claim to be made. If it's a claim that sounds in tort and there's no other statute that authorizes that claim to be made, it is considered to be a claim that could be brought under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And I really think that the best case to kind of to work through this
is the argument that's being made by the appellees here has been made with regard to 057 and rejected at least on two occasions by the Supreme Court.
Yes.
In a defamation context or an intentional tort context.
In an intentional tort context.
Okay.
And
so the court has signed off on, doesn't matter that it says the chapter doesn't apply. Okay?
Correct.
It doesn't matter that it says the chapter doesn't apply because 0215B doesn't say subsection or immunity or anything about it. It says the entire chapter doesn't apply.
Correct.
Under the circumstances. But in the context of 057 and intentional torts, Supreme Court has blown past that language and said, you know what, we're going to apply it for 101-106F purposes regardless of what this says. And
yes.
we're going to apply the proprietary downstream.
Well, and
in which cases are those cases?
Newman versus Obersteller was the first case back in 1997, which dealt with a previous version of 101.106F. More recently was Alexander versus Weaver, which dealt with intentional tort claims, including malicious prosecution and conspiracy, among others. And those are cited in the brief. But the reason being, and I think this is important, and really I think the best case to read is the Franca versus Velasquez case, which has an extended discussion of why these issues of the ultimate applicability of governmental immunity and will the Texas Tort Claims Act ultimately apply and will the plaintiff actually bring their claims pursuant to the Texas Tort Claims Act. You decide that after the pleadings have been amended and the governmental entity has been brought into the case, as is required by 101.106F. Because if you do it on the front end, and they talk about this in Franca, it can lead to all sorts of confusing and inconsistent results. First of all, you're going to be litigating the applicability of governmental immunity before the governmental employer is a party to the case. If it's ever made a party to the case, whatever decision might have been made about that issue is not binding upon it because it wasn't there when it happened. So you're going to litigate it again. Also, the Supreme Court talks about the fact that it requires, to do it that way would require the governmental employee at the 101.106F stage to argue that his employer's immunity had been waived. This is a claim for which my employer's immunity has been waived, so you should bring them in. That's normally a position the employee wouldn't take. It also would require the plaintiff to argue the governmental entity's immunity has not been waived to avoid 101.106F, a position the plaintiff would not normally take. Then, if for some reason the governmental entity is brought in later, it will be pointing to the arguments the plaintiff made previously to say its immunity is not waived, whereas the plaintiff will be pointing to arguments made by the entity's employee that immunity was waived, contrary to what it argued at the 101.106F stage.
Doesn't that beg the question as to whether it's a governmental function versus a proprietary function?
Well, it begs the question, but again, it needs to be determined when the governmental entity is a party. And that's what Franca talks about specifically, and if the court will indulge me, I'll quote a section from that opinion. This is Franca versus Velasquez, 332 Southwest 3rd at 381. Quote, properly construed, section 101.106F's two conditions are met in almost every negligence suit against a governmental employee. He acted within the general scope of his employment, and suit could have been brought under the act. That is, his claim is in tort and not under another statute that independently waives immunity. In such cases, the suit is considered to be against the employee in the employee's official capacity only, and the plaintiff must promptly dismiss the employee and sue the governmental entity. And this is the critical part. The governmental immunity issue need not be determined until the governmental unit is in the suit and the issue can be fully addressed. That's the Texas Supreme Court in Franca versus Velasquez. And that's exactly what should have happened here.
Is there a difference between deciding whether something is a governmental function as opposed to whether the government is entitled to governmental immunity?
No. Because if it's a governmental function, they're entitled to governmental immunity. That's the issue.
But if it's not a governmental function, then governmental immunity is irrelevant.
Correct. That's correct. And what the Supreme Court is saying is you get to litigate that issue, but you do it once you bring the governmental entity into the case. That's what's contemplated by 101.106F. That's why they've allowed intentional tort claims to be considered claims that could be brought under this act, even though they're specifically excepted from the act. So if the plaintiffs are correct about their proprietary function argument, if they had done what was required by 101.106F, amended their petition, brought the city in, they could then make those arguments to the extent the city raised governmental immunity arguments. And if they're correct, this would have happened months ago. Right now, they would be litigating those claims against the city of Mineral Wells, with the city unable to claim any immunity protections or monetary liability caps under the Tort Claims Act. That could have happened. But for that to happen under the terms of the statute, they have to amend their petition and bring those claims against the city. If they don't, within 30 days of the motion, the claims against the individual shall be dismissed. It's mandatory. In this instance, plaintiffs chose to stand on their pleadings, maintain their claims against Mr. Howerton individually, and argue that 101.106F has no application to their claims based on an argument, essentially, that's been decided by the Supreme Court back in 1997. And again,
where they effectively amended the statute on public policy grounds and
yes,
ignored the actual language of the statute. Well, which is their prerogative to do. They do it all the time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
So, again, I think the operative case to look at is Franca versus Velasquez. I think also Weaver versus Alexander.
Well, I understand Franca versus Velasquez sets forth the public policy reason for why they're doing what they were doing, okay? Let me ask you this, and nobody has brought this up, but this is something I had to deal with back when I was in private practice, and there is a similar provision with regard to military personnel under the Federal Tort Claims Act, under the Gonzales Act and the Westfall Act. Have you guys looked at that at all in terms of whether or not that ended up informing how the Supreme Court reached what the decision it did?
I don't recall, and Franca particularly, the Federal Tort Claims Act being a part of that analysis, Your Honor.
Okay. Because it was a similar type of argument or a similar type of provision where in the instance I came across it, it's a Fifth Circuit case called Wheeler. If in fact the doctor is, in that instance, it was an Air Force physician. 2 years into litigation on a state Med-Mal claim, the United States kicked in and substituted in for the doctor, and we argued that all the way up to the Fifth Circuit, and both the Westfall Act and the Gonzales Act have that type of substitution, and the whole point is to make the United States or to make the governmental entity the true target one way or the other, so that the people who are actually working on it, the employees doing things within the scope of their employment, actually don't have to deal with the litigation. So,
and it's my understanding that I think those are the legislative concerns behind 101.106, but I don't recall seeing a discussion of the Federal Tort Claims Act in Franca or the other cases. But I think that's generally what the purpose of this is they want the governmental entity the target, not the individual employees. And certainly under the previous version of 101.106, it was easier to avoid that by simply suing the individual and not suing the governmental employee. They would avoid governmental immunity issues, statutory cap issues, so forth. The amendments that gave us the statute we have now make that more difficult to do, and I think that's on purpose.
Are you aware at all with regard to what were government employees immune at common law with regard to proprietary activities before the Tort Claims Act provided for this situation? In other words, what was the predecessor to 101.106F in terms of What was the legislature trying to fix there?
Well, if I, the predecessor to 101.106, if I recall correctly, said that when claims were settled or judgment was received against the governmental entity, then you were forever barred from pursuing it against the governmental employee. And then there was some case law that developed around that. But it was easy to avoid that by just not suing the government. You would just sue the individual employee. And there wasn't a provision such as there now is under 101.106F that would allow the employee or the governmental entity, well, the employee, to get the governmental entity substituted into the case. That's new. And I'm sorry as to whether governmental employees at common law could be liable for proprietary functions. I won't hazard a guess on that because I really don't
know.
Fine. But I would.
If you know.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. To follow up on the last question you just asked Justice Birdwell, in the Franca case, following the portion that he quoted, the Supreme Court noted that prior to the passage of the Texas Tort Claims Act, while a governmental entity may have enjoyed immunity, the governmental employee never did. So the predecessor, what the rule was before Texas Tort Claims Act, is that the employee could always be sued and enjoyed no claim of immunity. Based on my very quick reading as I was following along. From my perspective, what we're here asking, well, what the appellant is here asking this court to do is to add language in or disregard the express text of the statute.
But counsel has indicated that it is the Supreme Court that's already added the language in, so how are we to decide that that was inappropriate on the part of the Supreme Court?
Well, for two reasons. One, as he mentioned, the Supreme Court has never addressed the issue of 101.0215B. So you do not have any controlling precedent guiding you on that question. He's asking you to analogize from another statute.
Well, but they've had the opportunity from very similar language with regard to intentional torts.
I agree. However,
and if they've already addressed it with regard to the language in 057, why should we not be interpreting it as the legislature having the same opportunity? And the legislature has not amended 057 or amended 101-106F or E for that matter with regard to the determination of the Supreme Court in the Newman case and the Alexander case.
My response to that is twofold. First, I believe that counsel is reading too far into the opinions that he cited. I believe that some of those statements the Supreme Court has made are obiter dicta, that are not controlling. And that's particularly true with at least several of the cases that I've read. I would have to go back and look at the few that he's referenced right now, but I know that to be the case. Second,
and I'll let you get to your second point, do you have a problem generally, though, with our looking to how the court has dealt with similar language in Chapter 101, i.e., that this a chapter does not apply language, okay, and saying that the court would interpret 0215B and that language similarly under the circumstances?
Yes, for those points that I'm raising. One, it's obiter dicta from the opinions that he has cited to the Supreme Court, and I understand the holding with respect to 057. However, we're dealing with 0215B. So while if you believe that it's not obiter dicta, at most it would be persuasive, and I can admit to you that it would be strongly persuasive, but for it being obiter dicta, but it's not controlling. So the question I believe before this court is, do you, justices, on a case of first impression, ignore the canons of statutory interpretation, chunk them out the window, and add additional language into this statute that does not exist? I do not believe that this court should accept that invitation to do so. If you were presented with a situation, which this is not, where there were controlling authority, I think you would have no choice. That makes it pretty easy. But you're confronting a case of first impression. As far as I can tell, and I believe from what Justice Birdwell said, from what his research has indicated as well.
Let's take a little bit further. Are you confident, given the fact that Supreme Court has granted the petition in City of League City versus Jimmy Changa's Inc., that your position that this development is proprietary and doesn't fall within subsection A34 in the governmental function? Are you confident in that, or is that something maybe we should wait and see what the Supreme Court does?
I'm very confident this is a proprietary function we presented.
I mean, they're basically in Westworth Village versus White Settlement, we pretty much came to that conclusion, but we weren't dealing with Chapter 373 or 374. I think we were dealing with 380.
I think it was a 380, 381 agreement.
But the Supreme Court apparently is going to try and resolve the conflict between our court and I forget the other court that decided basically that A34 applies to all economic development that a municipality does.
I believe that this court reached the correct decision. I do find it interesting that petition's been granted. I will like to see what that opinion is. However, if the Supreme Court follows what I believe is well-established precedent and, frankly, common sense, when you have a situation such as an economic incentive agreement or a relocation package incentive agreement, which is what we have here, that is not for the benefit of citizens at large. It's for the benefit of the citizens within that municipality only. And I think the law has clearly established that that creates a proprietary function or constitutes a proprietary function as opposed to governmental under multiple opinions from various appellate courts.
But it looks like the court's going to figure out whether or not we got Westworth Village correct.
And I'm betting they're going to figure out that this court did get Westworth Village correct.
You're so nice to say so.
Yeah, well, it does suit me here today.
Yes, it does. I'll tell Chief Justice Sutter that you have a great confidence in her opinion.
Absolute confidence. So what I'm asking here is that you decline the invitation of the appellant to ignore the jurisprudence of Texas as it relates to statutory interpretation. Everything that you are being invited to do here today runs in direct contradiction to those rules. Therefore, I think it should be rejected. You do not have any controlling precedent that would require you to reach that decision. I do recognize that you may have some persuasive authority based upon another section of Chapter 106 that admittedly does have similar language. But I think really what this court needs to do is, as you review those cases that the appellant has cited in support of its position, figure out, is that truly a holding of the Texas Supreme Court, or is it dicta? Is it binding? Was it necessary to make that statement to reach the decision that was made? If it's not, then oftentimes, and respectfully, you fellows and lady are justices, but if the issue is not as critical to the holding, sometimes it's not as well reasoned. And that's the entire reason why we're taught from law school that dicta is something that you need to be very, very careful about. And I know this court knows that. So we would ask you to affirm the decision of the trial court, which is the denial of the motion to dismiss, because on its face, it is supported by the express statutory text set forth in Chapter 101. And we've also presented in our brief a number of cases that flesh out the proprietary governmental function distinction, which I'm sure this court has a great deal of familiarity with, considering the case that we're talking about, Westworth Village. But when that happens, when we're dealing with a proprietary function, no one enjoys immunity. And that's the end of the inquiry. You could sue the city all day long. And if you could sue the city all day long, why can't you sue the employee? Especially when the employee is the one that carried out what we allege, and that's what we're at this point. We're presuming the factual allegations that are contained in my petition are correct, that the gentleman who's the appellant here committed fraud by making false representations and failing to disclose information when he had an obligation to do so. I don't have anything else further to offer unless you have questions for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just briefly, Your Honor. Again, appellant is not inviting the court to disregard principles of statutory interpretation. What appellant is asking the court to do is apply established Texas Supreme Court precedent that I think upon your review of it, you will find addresses the issue at hand. Specifically,
are there
the issue.
Any other instances other than the intentional tort language in 057 where the court has dealt with this claim doesn't, you know, this chapter does not apply language, a 101, 106E case or anything of that nature that would be similar one way or the other, or are you basically going to rely on the intentional tort cases?
No, I'm not only relying upon those, but and they're cited within both the original brief and the reply brief. There's several cases discussing how you determine the could have been brought language, and some of those deal with things that don't have to do with intentional torts, but they all discuss, and I think you'll find this is not dicta, and getting away for a moment from a situation where you have a provision of the act that says this chapter does not apply to. There are several cases, Supreme Court and Court of Appeals cases, that talk about, and I mentioned this briefly, how you do this analysis of whether a claim could have been brought under the Tort Claims Act. And it's as I mentioned to you, there's two issues. Does it sound in tort? Is there some statute that specifically authorizes it to be made against the government?
But those usually, okay, were an argument about the fact that if you dismiss the employees, you're dismissing and bring the municipality in or the governmental unit in, you are effectively going to dismiss the entirety of the case because the claim that is being made doesn't implicate the waiver of immunity under the Texas Tort Claims Act. So the fight, and that this was, I believe, the case in Franca, is over whether or not there is an effect, there is in fact a case that can be made against the state. And so the plaintiffs are always fighting to make sure the employees stay in if they don't know whether or not they can make a good argument that there's a waiver, which is why the Supreme Court went pretty much where they went, is because, well, we need to make this determination and it really doesn't matter. We can't make that determination about immunity first, okay, because then we're considering the ultimate merits of the claim type of thing. We need to do this procedurally, and that's generally how those cases have been postured. I'm going to go back and read the 057 cases, but that's generally where the fight has been, is please don't do this to us because there's not a waiver there. So how can you say that the case can be brought under the Tort Claims Act when there's no actual waiver there? And the court in its reasoning said, we don't have to reach the merits one way or the other. Is it a tort? That's why they came up with the analysis that you're asking us to apply under the circumstances.
Well, that's correct, but again, I see no reason why that wouldn't be applicable in this situation. And in fact, what you just mentioned made it even less problematic, because in cases, as you mentioned, sometimes this is raised in the context of, judge, if you do this to us, we're not going to be able to sue the governmental entity because immunity hadn't been waived.
Well, but that's why the court did what it did in Franco, is like, okay, but if every time we do this, we look and see if we hold that a case brought under the Texas Tort Claims Act, okay, has to be a viable waiver case, okay, then in every instance where there's not a waiver, what you're going to end up with are the employees are going to be the targets.
Right.
Okay. And therefore, the government's immune, but the employees get targeted, which seems to undermine what the legislature was actually trying to do here. So I understand the reasoning. I'm still dealing, but the court never actually specifically dealt with the actual language that we're dealing with here. So I'm gonna try and look and see. I understand your arguments, and if I think we're bound by it, then I think we're gonna end up having to do what we're bound to do. But I'm gonna make sure that that's what we're actually dealing with, because it just flat they have not dealt with the 0215B argument.
If I may briefly, Your Honor.
Sure.
All I was going to say was this case is postured as a much less difficult decision in that regard, because if the plaintiffs are correct, the City of Mineral Wells can assert immunity to this claim.
Right.
They're not being cost their lawsuit. They still have their lawsuit unchanged if they're correct. So why under those circumstances?
That's my point. If the posture of this case, which is different than what Franca is and some of these other cases, does that change anything with regard to the application, given the fact we're dealing with a new provision that hasn't been dealt with before? So anyway, thank you very much, counsel. The case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we appreciate your arguments.